Hey everybody, what is going on? Today we are going to be giving you the first specific topic for the Eric's Trees, Forest, Arborist, and Dirt podcast. So don't forget that sometimes I will be using the full title, Eric's Trees, Forest, Arborist, and Dirt podcast, but sometimes I will also be using the acronym or just the initials, which is ETFAD podcast. So look for both of those or do a search for both of those and you'll find us. Also, if you're interested, you can also check out my other podcast, which is Elevated Office Podcast, which is for tree workers, tree climbers, arborists, tree services, and things like that, where we talk about safety techniques. We talk about climbing topics that are common and equipment, and we do reviews there. We'll also be doing a ton of reviews here. So make sure to subscribe to both podcasts. If you want to support this, then you can also use the subscription feature in the Elevated Office podcast and subscribe. It's as low as $3 a month. So you can think about it as buying me a coffee, which would be greatly appreciated as I continue to progress in these topics. Now, today we're going to talk about some things that people often don't think about or misunderstand when they're getting into the medium-sized to micro forestry industry, specifically when considering buying equipment or running equipment such as track loaders, skid steers, that kind of stuff with forestry heads on them, or equipment they might buy that they think is for forestry that is possibly not quite as good as they might have thought or won't work quite as well, or they think they have enough experience with it because of other industries they've been in, but quickly find out that, well, they were mistaken. So understand that these are common topics, common situations that I run into. This is not to say that everybody will actually have these problems. So talking about that, what I find is that a lot of guys own a chainsaw of some sort. Maybe they were a construction worker, maybe they're a excavation company, and they have like a Husky Rancher or a Farm Boss or something like that, and they think that they have a decent sized chainsaw and that that will be enough for forestry work. Now, don't forget, we're not specifically talking about logging in this because logging is really a different kind of world. The equipment they use often is different. Some of it's the same. Of course, some of it crosses over. Some of it's very, very different. And depending on where you're at with logging, might be different as well. So we're not going to specifically talk about that today in what we're referring to, but we're talking about like land clearing, some forestry work like forest thinning, things like that. To, you know, these are jobs that a lot of guys getting into this will run across. Like maybe somebody has an overgrown forest in the back of their house. Maybe it was logged 100 years ago. It started to recover. It's super dense and thick. They want it cleaned out. They want to keep mature trees. They want to build a renewable forest that will replace the older trees as they die out and that kind of stuff. So they want the undergrowth kind of managed and everything like that. Or maybe they just have stands of trees that are super dense, clustered. There's a lot of dead in them and they need to get them out. So they hire a forestry or a land clearing company. Or maybe there are some fields out there that have just been neglected for long periods of time. They have become fallow, they have become overgrown, and now they want to refurbish and restore those fields so that they can be used for cultivating again and things like that, which really that whole restoration of land becomes a different process. Some of the processes are the same, so we'll talk about a little bit, but there really becomes a different level when it comes to trying to get them to where you can actually plow them and use them and things like that again. It's a multi-process step and sometimes even a multi-year process, depending on where you live and what's going on. So the first thing that I find is that, like I said, people have a pickup truck and a chainsaw and they think, and this goes hand in hand with tree service companies, they think that they can be a tree service or a forestry company because they have a relatively decent sized chainsaw. What I will tell you about that is that while I have owned ranchers, I actually own a still Farm Boss they are not particularly the best saws for logging or for forestry work. And there are a number of reasons for this. One is that they're not really built to the same quality as like the Steel 400s or the 462s or the 500 or the 362s, those more professional grade saws. The casing is not quite the same. The carburetors and stuff are decent quality, but they're tuned a little bit differently and you have to work with them to get them where you want. Some of them have governors on them that don't allow them to really run as efficiently unless you start messing with all of that stuff. And they often just weigh heavier than their professional counterparts. So you don't get as much power for the weight relationship, and they oftentimes, when you're using them day in and day out, just aren't quite as reliable. I have experienced this firsthand. I know a few other guys who have done the same. There is a reason that us professionals go with the much higher priced and much more professional systems, or, you know, in this case, tools of the trade, which would be, in my case, mainly steel. I am not a steel fanboy. I don't believe that steel is so much better than Husky. I know a lot of people out there are very dedicated to Husky or to steel or whatever. I think Husqvarna and steel both make great saws. Here where I live, steel is just way more represented. And so everything I own pretty much is steel. But that being said, I have had a Husky, and I also had a, what's it called? A Chinese knockoff, which is a John's Red, that was a direct knockoff of a copy of the Huskies. And I actually love that saw. I still have it. There's some reasons I don't use it as much anymore, but we'll get into some of that detail in the future. That was more based on like tree climbing and stuff for my art, for my tree service and arborist company, but still kind of applies to what we're talking about today. So a lot of guys will think that they are going to be able to go out there with a $300 saw and a pickup truck, and they're going to be able to start felling trees and make some money. And to be honest, you probably can. However, the difference between a high quality chainsaw and a mid-grade, like a prosumer saw as they're often called, is significant when you're felling trees or bucking up trees, especially in difficult terrain day in and day out for 12 hours a day or 10 hours a day for, you know, months on end. If you start out like that, you're probably going to find out that you're going to make some money with the saw for a little bit, and then you're probably going to have to do a lot of repairs to the saw, just constant maintenance to it that would not be required on a more professional level saw. And it's probably not a terrible thing to have as a backup, but I don't recommend you start off with that, to be honest. I just find that they don't have the cutting power as a general rule. You know, sometimes I don't remember if it's the case with the steels or not, but sometimes the bar mounts are different and therefore you're more limited on bars. The, it would also limit, if the bar mounts are different, what size chain you can run. So you're going to have potentially dulling and stretching issues with your chains, depending on what size chain you can run. You might not be able to run chains that just cut as well in general. So, you know, there's a lot to this really that goes unknown to people who are just trying to get in it. They see some guy out there with a chainsaw and he's doing forestry and clearing, and they think that they can just do it themselves as well. Also, it's really fast and easy to take trees down if you know what you're doing. If you don't, and I've seen some cases where people clearly did not know what they were doing, it can be super dangerous. And not only that, but people often underestimate what it takes to get the trees off the ground once they're felled. So, like, I'm not going to say that felling trees, especially in a forest environment, is easy, because it's super dangerous. People don't even realize how dangerous that is. There's so many factors. We'll talk about that in the future as well. But once you've gotten it down, and let's say that felling it is the easy part, once you've gotten 100 trees down on the ground or 30 trees down on the ground, the hard part is actually getting those trees cleaned up. It becomes very time consuming without the right equipment or without the right planning. People underestimate that. I've seen a number of guys get hired because they were the cheapest guy in, you know, in the bid area for the client. And as that occurs, they get all these trees on the ground and then they kind of abandon the job because they didn't have the setup needed. They didn't have the foresight, the planning, or the experience to know how to manage it. And it became so overwhelming. It took so much more time than they expected that they couldn't afford to finish it. And then the customers left. You've now created a bad name for yourself. And they're calling somebody in like me who can come in and take care of the job. So that being said, I'm not going to lie. I have bid a few jobs where I underestimated what it would take to get the jobs done. Now, the difference is I have just eaten it and gone on and finished the job. And unfortunately, due to certain circumstances, some of the jobs ended not so great with the customer. But the reality is I finished the job. So whatever they have to say, the truth of it is I still finished the job and it was on my dime. There's a couple that I just totally ate it and I made no money whatsoever. All I did is spend a lot of money to finish the job. So you can get yourself into that situation really quick. The other thing is a lot of guys think, oh, I'll get a skid steer. Even if it's just felling, right? They'll be like, I'll fell and I'll get a set of forks because forks are cheap. I'll use this and I will load a log truck or something. Well, a couple of factors that come into play, and I've run into this a few times, not with myself because I do my math and stuff first, but first off, forks on a skid for loading log trucks it's possible, but it's often a bad idea just simply because if the ground is uneven at all, forks don't hold the logs in place. The log just slides back and forth across the forks, and it can be hard to control them first off. If the ground is uneven where you're loading, it can be hard to hold on to the logs on forks. That's first and foremost. Second off, a lot of times people think about getting a log truck in to load logs onto, but they don't realize that their skid cannot actually go over the uprights. It can't lift over those. And some log trucks you can with certain kinds of skids if they have a high enough pin, you know, rating for lift. Some you absolutely cannot. And you could hire a guy to come out there, and some drivers won't ask you what you're going to load with. They just assume you know what you're doing. They get out there and then you're stuck. So you have to either build a platform, build a ramp, something to load these trucks with, or you have to like pay the guy for his day of lost work. He goes on and now you're out of money and you have to figure out a different way to get these logs out, which in those cases often is trying to load logs into dump trucks or load them into dump trailers. And neither of those two options, as a general rule, is as efficient as a log truck. So before you get into a big logging project for forestry where you're thinning or whatever, and you think, hey, I've got firewood or I've got milling wood or whatever, make sure you've got all of your aspects of this work, you know, like buttoned down. You know what your skid can handle. Oh, the other thing is weight. Guys underestimate, they overestimate what their skids can pick up. Maybe they can pick up quite a bit. Remember, skids often have a weight rating of pickup at 50% and at 80% or 100%, depending on the brand. So, of lift. And that means that maybe you can lift 2,000 pounds or 2,500 pounds or 3,000 pounds or whatever at 50%. But that's a far cry from lifting all the way up to get it into a log trailer. And now you might find yourself having to pick up one log at a time, or maybe you can't even pick up the log. Maybe you have to actually cut the log in half to be able to get it up and get it in there. And that is something that first timers, you know, you might be laughing and might think to yourself, well, that's just stupid. When you're bidding jobs and there's so many details to keep in mind, you can overlook this stuff, and people underestimate just how much there is to the factors of these jobs and the difficulty of them, of calculating everything. And if you have the mindset to do it, then you're thinking, well, how would you not think about this? And that's great. You'll probably be successful in your work. But there are people out there that are scratching their head right now saying, I'd never even really considered that. And then you have the fact of if your skid will actually reach to go over the uprights of like a log truck or whatever. What is the ground like? Is it mainly wet? Is it mainly dry? Is it going to be mainly packed? Are you going to get it done before the wet season comes? Because if not, even though your skid technically could lift and load a log truck over the uprights, there's a chance that if the ground gets soggy, you can't anymore. 1 inch makes the difference of being able to or not do certain work at heights with skids. If the tires sink and the track sink, if you are right at that point, then you may not be able to do it. So there's all those kinds of factors, first off. Second off is that a lot of people think, oh, I'll get me a skid, I'll get out there and I can just do this work. Well, don't forget that depending on the kind of work that's being bid, and you need to look at all the details of what you're bidding, there's a good chance that the work might not allow you to only use your skid. You might actually have to do some handwork or have somebody do some handwork, and you need to make sure that you have the equipment to do that work, that you can do it the way that they want it to be done, and that it can be done to the quality that is required by the contractual agreement. So a lot of people, I hear guys all the time, oh, I'll get me a skid and I'll get me a masticator or a forestry head, and I'll go out there and I'll make me some money and I won't ever have to get out of the cab. Well, I find that the best paying and the most profitable jobs don't allow me to stay in the cab 100% of the time. Now, ideally, I try to work it where I can figure out how much time I have to be out of the cab versus in the cab and all that. But the reality of it is that that's not always the case. Sometimes there has to be some hand chipping. So maybe you need a chipper. Sometimes there has to be hand cut in the under canopy and around the trunk of trees that you can't get in with the forestry masticator, and you have to do that. Or sometimes you can't damage the other trees, so you have to hand fell certain sections because it's too narrow for you to get in with a machine, or you can't control as well with the machine. There's all kinds of factors that go into those aspects. So the idea that you can just get in there and do you know, everything with a machine and that's all that's required can be misleading at times. So before you just start taking and bidding on jobs, understand what the job really requires. This is going to be very, very important if you're doing any kind of government work. So the forestry agencies, when they contract out, they have these programs, they have a prescription from a forester or a forestry agent or a arborist, and you have to follow those. And if you do not, you don't get paid. They are very strict about that as a general rule. Also, like here where we live, we have forest fire issues because we're in Colorado in the mountains, and there's a lot of pinyon pine here. There's also a lot of ponderosa pine. There are a ton of firs and spruces and things like that. There's a lot of beetle kill, which creates these dry patches in the forest that are now even more flammable. And so they have very strict requirements. And like in the area where I live, there's a ton of forestry that has to be done for fire mitigation around homes. And in these large neighborhoods where everybody owns 35 acres each. And when that becomes the situation, they won't allow you to work until it's after October 15th. And if it's a really warm year, you may not even be able to work until like November 15th or November 1st. And you have to stop work before March 15th. And if it's been a really cold year, maybe they'll let you go into April a little bit, depending, because of the Ips beetle. And the Ips beetle is in flight, and they suspect that the Ips beetle is drawn by pheromone of fresh cut pinyon pine when it's sapping out to create woundwood and starting to try to cover over wounds that have been created during the cutting process. And so they attack the tree. And if the tree is, of course, already in distress, then that tree becomes potentially incapable of defending itself. And now you have a situation where you are drawing potentially beetles to a tree, and you are increasing the infestation is basically the concept. So that means that we have to do our work for this kind of job when it comes time. after October 15th. Well, snow here often flies in early to mid-November. And then depending on the kind of year, this year has been pretty dry as of December 2023. So we're talking about the 2023 and 2024 winter. The winter has been pretty dry. We haven't had too much snow. It's not been a big deal. But some years it is a big deal, and they won't pay you until the job has been completed and the prescription has been signed off on by a forester. So if you start work in October and in November you get snowed out and you can't finish that job at all that year, let's say you can work a little bit in February and March, but you still don't finish, you don't get paid until the following October or November when you finish the job. And so you're out of money out of your pocket from the company for every day worked and all the fuel expense and all that stuff from the past year. So you have to be able to calculate in what potentially might occur, what you can take on. And this becomes a real issue for some of the guys that are getting into this industry. When they take on big jobs, like maybe they take on two properties, so they have 70 acres and they're trying to get these done, or maybe it's a 35 acre job, but it's a really difficult terrain area and they don't know what to do with it. And they underestimate how long or how hard it'll be to, you know, winch logs up out of ravines and over cliffs and whatever, which is part of what we have to do from time to time out here. And now they have to pay their guys for, let's say, a month or two of work and all the fuel expenses and equipment expenses, but they're not getting any of that money back until they finish the job the following spring, or I'm sorry, the following autumn and fall. So it becomes a challenge at times, and you see guys rush into these things. They make bad decisions. They underbid. A lot of guys are told about these kinds of jobs and they're like, oh, I can just make tons of money. And they go buy a brand new skid steer. They buy all the attachments. They go out there and they don't realize how much wear and tear the forestry units put on skids. They think that it's like a dirt machine and it wears out your skids oftentimes, way faster. Your compact track loaders and things wear tracks faster. You have to do oil changes more frequently a lot of times. It wears bushings, brakes stuff. And we'll talk about some of that in the future of what I've experienced and what some local guys that I know have experienced. So there's a lot to that. And then of course there's the whole, thinking that maybe somebody has a bit of experience in operating skid steers and compact track loaders in construction or whatnot and farm work, and they have some experience and maybe they're very good at what they do, and that's great. If they are, then they'll have a leg up, and if they're very astute learners, then they'll figure out how to do things faster and correct their problems. But I will tell you, everybody that I've ever spoken to, and I have experience with this myself, everybody that I've ever known that started out in dirt work that got into forestry running skid steers and track machines like that has said you have to operate the machine differently in the forest than you do in construction. And the problem is a lot of people think that they have experience with compact track loaders or skid steers, and they do, and they might be proficient at it to a certain level, but there's a whole different world of what's going on in the forest and how that affects you, especially if you're in any kind of like boggy areas or if you are in like mountain ranges. So like where we're at here, we have a really weird kind of scenario where we have rock outcroppings that are sometimes a few inches tall to a couple of feet tall, and they're on down slopes, and you're like squeezing through with these big pieces of equipment and forestry heads on, and you have to like fell a tree with it, and you have to back up and know where you're at. And sometimes you can like, because they're rock outcroppings, it gets dusty and slick, and you can actually, when you're moving backwards, slide downhill quite a bit. And it takes a whole different kind of operating is all I can say. It's very, very different. Also, some people don't understand all of the safety features that you need for your compact track loaders, like the polycarbonate and Lexan doors that can be upwards of, you know, like almost $3,000 for just the door. Then does your machine, it technically has the GPM flow for high flow for what you're doing, but can the machine get up and down the hills with that on it? And so I've seen a number of guys go out and spend, you know, $180,000 on a machine and the forestry head, and they really can't use it because they can't push the machine up hills with it. And then the same thing goes with trucks and trailers. They buy a truck that technically can handle the weight of the skid and all that stuff in the trailer, but then they find that the truck was not capable of hauling it into the forest where it needed to go and things because it was borderline on the power and weight. There are so many factors that I see people get into with forestry. And then if you're on some of the U.S. forestry jobs, they require you to have a water truck and in case something occurs. And so that's an extra cost that people didn't realize until they got into looking at the bid and they bought this equipment to be able to do these jobs. And now they don't have the total amount of equipment that they need. And then renting a water truck is not cheap. And the water truck doesn't make you any money. It just sits there in case of emergency. So somebody had the idea that they were going to like get this kind of work. And then they realized that they can't even do that kind of work. Now they're scrambling to try to figure out what to do with that investment they had. They're trying to sell the machine or, you know, whatever it might be. There's a ton of it. And then there's also the, what do you do with the difference between the drum masticators, the disc mulchers, and the brush cutters? Which ones should you buy? And how do they all work? And the brush cutters and drum masticators, there's a million options for them. Disc mulchers, there's a lot fewer options, but they have very specific and particular weirdnesses about them, like quirks that you need to know. And so I've seen a number of people buy disc mulchers and then realize that was like a really bad investment. And then they have a hard time selling the disc mulchers. Disc mulchers don't sell very well. That's just the reality. Drum mulchers are typically going to sell better, but there's so many options. You have to know what you're doing and what kind of knives and cutters. Are the holders welded on or replaceable? Are the cutters, can you find the teeth very easily? There's a whole bunch that a lot of people, like, they jump into it and they don't know what they're doing and they get themselves in trouble. So these are things I want you guys to keep in mind and think and research before you all start trying to get into this industry. Like, what kind of work, first off, is available? What can you use it for? Now, I know that here in town, there is a company that contracts to the railroad that's out here. I can't remember what railroad it is. They don't just work here in my town, but they do like multiple states. They run the Cat 299s with a Cat, which is, I think, an FAE branded, like rebranded masticator, drum masticator that's branded Cat. They run those to do the line and train rail clearing. It does a good enough job. However, the problem is that, like, a lot of what we have out here is this, what they call desert willow or reedy grasses and cattails and stuff in these areas where there's ditches and water lies a little bit, or it's just that tall prairie grass. And to be honest, the drum masticators don't do a great job of cutting and mulching that stuff. It kind of tears it out of the ground and it just whips it around the drum and it eventually falls off or it gets wrapped up and they have to stop and get it out and pull it off and whatever. So while overall, if they're going to buy one piece of equipment, in their case, it's going to be the drum masticator because they do run into wood and trees and whatever on the sides of the railroad lines. For other people, they might buy a drum masticator and find out that 10% of their work is really tree oriented and 80% of it's more like wispy, willowy, reedy kind of brush and grass, and the drum masticator doesn't work nearly as well for them. Or maybe there's too many rock outcroppings and they keep breaking teeth on the drum, whereas a brush cutter would have been a better option. And it's, they, but now they've invested all their money in the drum masticator and they can't afford the brush cut. It's very complex. Or they think that the drum masticators are indestructible. A lot of people tell me they're just indestructible. I can guarantee you they are not. There is a lot of destruction that goes on with drum masticators. And a drum masticator, when it breaks down and when it gets damaged, is extremely expensive to fix in a lot of ways. So before you jump into all this, I hope you can do some research on it. And as this podcast goes on, we'll start breaking down each of these topics and talking a little bit more about what you might want to research, what research I have found, some opinions that I have heard from people that use them, and my own personal experience using these devices and what I think is a good option for you. Now, this is not just for, once again, compact track loaders and skid steers and masticators and whatever. We're going to talk a little bit about the differences in the future of what the difference between a purpose dedicated machine is for forestry versus the skid steers versus brush cutters and mowers for like center articulating compact loaders versus mini skids versus all that kind of stuff. And we're also going to talk about the benefits, pros and cons of different kinds of attachments for skid steers for mowing and mulching and clearing versus handheld, I guess you could call them handheld, brush cutters or walk behind brush cutters and that kind of stuff. The reality of it is all of these can have a place, and you have to decide what to invest in, because you can start trying to invest in it all and you just can't afford it all. So it's really figuring out what you're doing and where they fit best. And that's what I'm hoping to be able to help you guys out with all this equipment and this tech, you know, all these talks that we're talking about. And what to know before you get into these things, so that you can have a better idea of what you might actually have on your plate as a real ownership cost, which, I've seen a bunch of guys do that. They buy all this equipment and they had no idea the real ownership cost, and it sinks them. And, going to be honest with you, I went through a period with my skid and, it was not working the way it should. Warranty was not being followed up by the company as well as it should have, in my opinion. And it came close to sinking me. It was a paperweight that I was paying, you know, over $1,000 a month on to sit there and not work. And that becomes very hard. And the residential tree work had kind of slowed down. And like I said, we'll talk about this stuff in the future as well, but it became a challenge. So I am not speaking to you as if I am immune and make perfect decisions. You can make a great decision. And if the equipment goes bad, it's not always your fault and you're still stuck with it. So there are a bunch of things that I think people should know before they jump into this industry, because this industry is not a cheap industry to get into. And it can sink you very, very quickly if you can't manage it somehow. And you should always have contingency A, B, and C, because you never know when one of the others is going to fail you. So I hope this helps you guys out. Please don't forget that you can check out my other podcast, Elevated Office Podcast, which is a tree climbers podcast. It's about arborists and tree service work and tree climbing. We also talk about chainsaws and gear, do a bunch of reviews over there. And we also talk about techniques and safety and different things like that, concepts, ANSI standards and all that kind of stuff. So go check that out. If you want to help support this podcast, then you can also subscribe to the Elevated Office Podcast. Lowest subscription is only $3 a month. It's like buying me a coffee, but it does help pay for the space on the internet and the hosting of these podcasts, both that one and Eric's Trees, Forest, Arborist, and Dirt podcast. So thank you for checking this out, and feel free to reach out to me. Is there a topic you would like me to talk about? Did I miss something? Do you feel like I underrepresented something or overrepresented something? I'd like to know your opinion, and we will talk to you guys in the next one. Take care.